I can tell you best what he is by telling you what Doctor's Commons is. It's a little out-of-the-way place where they administer what is called ecclesiastical law and play all kinds of tricks with obsolete old monsters of Acts of Parliament, which three-fourths of the world know nothing about and the other fourth supposes to have been dug up in a fossil state in the days of the Edwards. It's a place that has an ancient monopoly in suits about people's wills and people's marriages and disputes among ships and boats. Nonsense, Steerforth, I exclaimed. You don't mean to say that there's any affinity between nautical matters and ecclesiastical matters? I don't indeed, my dear boy, he returned, but I mean to say that they are managed and decided by the same set of people down in that same Doctor's Commons. You shall go there one day and find them blundering through half the nautical terms in Young's Dictionary apropos of the Nancy having run down the Sarah Jane, or Mr. Peggotty and the Yarmouth boatman having put off in a gale of wind with an anchor and cable to the Nelson Injurman in distress. And you shall go there another day and find them deep in the evidence pro and con respecting a clergyman who has misbehaved himself. And you shall find the judge in the nautical case, the advocate in the clergyman case, or contrariwise. They're like actors. And now a man's a judge, and now he's not a judge. Now he's one thing, now he's another. Now he's something else, change and change about. But it's always a very pleasant, profitable little affair of private theatricals, presented to an uncommonly select audience. But advocates and proctors are not one and the same, said I, a little puzzled, are they? No, returned Steerforth, the advocates are civilians. Men who've taken a doctor's degree at college, which is the first reason of my knowing anything about it. The proctors employ the advocates. Both get very comfortable fees, and altogether they make a mighty snug little party. On the whole, I would recommend you to take to Doctor's Commons kindly, David. They plume themselves on their gentility there, I can tell you, if there's any satisfaction. I made allowance for Steerforth's light way of treating the subject, and considering it with reference to the staid air of gravity and antiquity which I associated with that lazy old nook near St. Paul's Churchyard, did not feel indisposed towards my aunt's suggestion, which she left to my free decision, making no scruple of telling me that it had occurred to her, on her lately visiting her own proctor in Doctor's Commons for the purpose of settling her will in my favour. "That's a laudable proceeding on the part of our aunt at all events," said Steerforth when I mentioned it, "and one deserving of all encouragement. Daisy, my advice is that you take kindly to Doctor's Commons." I quite made up my mind to do so. I then told Steerforth that my aunt was in town awaiting me, as I found from her letter, and that she had taken lodgings for a week at a kind of private hotel in Lincoln's Inn Fields, where there was a stone staircase and a convenient door in the roof, my aunt being firmly persuaded that every house in London was going to be burnt down every night. We achieved the rest of our journey pleasantly, sometimes recurring to Doctor's Commons, and anticipating the distant days when I should be a proctor there, which Steerforth pictured in a variety of humorous and whimsical lights that made us both merry. When we came to our journey's end, he went home, engaging to call upon me next day but one, and I drove to Lincoln's Inn Fields, where I found my aunt up and waiting supper. If I'd been round the world since we parted, we could hardly have been better pleased to meet again. My aunt cried outright as she embraced me and said, pretending to laugh, that if my poor mother had been alive, that silly little creature would have shed tears, she had no doubt. "So you've left Mr. Dick behind, aunt," said I. "I'm sorry for that. Ah, Janet, how do you do?" As Janet curtsied, hoping I was well, I observed my aunt's visage lengthen very much. "I'm sorry for it, too," said my aunt, rubbing her nose. "I've had no peace of mind, Trot, since I've been here." Before I could ask why, she told me. "I am convinced," said my aunt, laying her hand with melancholy firmness on the table, "that Dick's character is not a character to keep the donkeys off. I'm confident he wants strength of purpose. I ought to have left Janet at home instead, and then my mind might perhaps have been at ease. If ever there was a donkey trespassing on my green," said my aunt with emphasis, "there was one this afternoon at 4 o'clock. A cold feeling came over me from head to foot, and I know it was a donkey." I tried to comfort her on this point, but she rejected consolation. It was a donkey, said my aunt, and it was the one with the stumpy tail which that murdering sister of a woman rode when she came to my house. This had been ever since the only name my aunt knew for Miss Murdstone. If there is any donkey in Dover whose audacity it's harder for me to bear than another's, that, said my aunt, striking the table, is the animal. Janet ventured to suggest that my aunt might be disturbing herself unnecessarily, and that she believed the donkey in question was then engaged in the sand and gravel line of business, and was not available for purposes of trespass, but my aunt wouldn't hear of it. Supper was comfortably served and hot, though my aunt's rooms were very high up. Whether that she might have more stone stairs for her money, or might be nearer to the door in the roof, I don't know, and consisted of a roast fowl, a steak, and some vegetables, to all of which I did ample justice, and which were all excellent. But my aunt had her own ideas concerning London provision, and ate but little. I suppose this unfortunate fowl was born and brought up in a cellar, said my aunt, and never took the air except on a hackney coach stand. I hope the steak may be beef, but I don't believe it. Nothing's genuine in the place, in my opinion, but the dirt. Don't you think the fowl may have come out of the country, aunt? I hinted. Certainly not, returned my aunt. It would be no pleasure to a London tradesman to sell anything which was what he pretended it was. I didn't venture to controvert this opinion, but I made a good supper, which it greatly satisfied her to see me do. When the table was cleared, Janet assisted her to arrange her hair, to put on a nightcap, which was of a smarter construction than usual, in case of fire, my aunt said, and to fold her gown back over her knees, these being her usual preparations for warming herself before going to bed. I then made her, according to certain established regulations from which no deviation, however slight, could ever be permitted, a glass of hot white wine and water, and a slice of toast cut into long, thin strips. With these accompaniments, we were left alone to finish the evening, my aunt sitting opposite to me, drinking her wine and water, soaking her strips of toast in it one by one before eating them, and looking benignantly on me from among the borders of her nightcap. "Well, Trot," she began, "what do you think of the Proctor plan? Or haven't you begun to think about it yet?"
"I've thought a good deal about it, my dear aunt, and I've talked a good deal about it with Steerforth. I like it very much indeed. I like it exceedingly."
"Come," said my aunt, "that's cheering."
"I have only one difficulty, aunt."
"Say what it is, Trot," she returned.
"Why, I want to ask, aunt, as it seems from what I understand to be a limited profession, whether my entrance into it wouldn't be very expensive."
"It will cost," returned my aunt, "to article you just £1,000.
"Now, my dear aunt," said I, drawing my chair nearer, "I'm uneasy in my mind about that. It's a large sum of money. You have expended a great deal on my education, and have always been as liberal to me in all things as it was possible to be. You've been the soul of generosity. Surely there are some ways in which I might begin life with hardly any outlay, and yet begin with a good hope of getting on by resolution and exertion. Are you sure that it wouldn't be better to try that course? Are you certain that you can afford to part with so much money, and that it is right it should be so expended? I only ask you, my second mother, to consider. Are you certain?" My aunt finished eating the piece of toast on which she was then engaged, looking me full in the face all the while, and then, setting her glass on the chimney-piece and folding her hands upon her folded skirts, replied as follows. "Trot, my child, if I have any object in life, it is to provide for your being a good, a sensible, and a happy man. I'm bent upon it, so is Dick. I should like some people that I know to hear Dick's conversation on the subject. Its sagacity is wonderful, but no one knows the resources of that man's intellect except myself." She stopped for a moment to take my hand between hers and went on. "It's in vain, Trot, to recall the past unless it works some influence upon the present. Perhaps I might have been better friends with your poor father. Perhaps I might have been better friends with that poor child, your mother, even after your sister Betsy Trotwood disappointed me. When you came to me, a little runaway boy, all dusty and wayworn, perhaps I thought so. from that time until now, Trot, you have ever been a credit to me and a pride and pleasure. I have no other claim upon my means. At least, here to my surprise she hesitated and was confused. No, I have no other claim upon my means, and you are my adopted child. Only be a loving child to me in my age, and bear with my whims and fancies, and you will do more for an old woman whose prime of life was not so happy or conciliating as it might have been than ever that old woman did for you. It was the first time I had heard my aunt refer to her past history. There was a magnanimity in her quiet way of doing so and of dismissing it, which would have exalted her in my respect and affection if anything could. "All is agreed and understood between us now, Trot," said my aunt, "and we need talk of this no more. Give me a kiss, and we'll go to the Commons after breakfast tomorrow." We had a long chat by the fire before we went to bed. I slept in a room on the same floor with my aunt's, and was a little disturbed in the course of the night by her knocking at my door as often as she was agitated by a distant sound of hackney coaches or market carts, and inquiring if I heard the engines. But towards morning she slept better and suffered me to do so too. At about midday we set out for the offices of Messrs. Spenlow and Jawkins in Doctors' Commons. My aunt, who had this other general opinion in reference to London, that every man she saw was a pickpocket, gave me her purse to carry for her, which had 10 guineas in it and some silver. We made a pause at the toy shop in Fleet Street to see the giants of St. Dunstan's strike upon the bells. We timed our going so as to catch them at it at 12 o'clock, and then went on towards Ludgate Hill in St. Paul's Churchyard. We were crossing to the former place when I found that my aunt greatly accelerated her speed and looked frightened. I observed at the same time that a lowering, ill-dressed man who had stopped and stared at us in passing a little before was coming so close after us as to brush against her. "Trot! My dear Trot!" cried my aunt in a terrified whisper and pressing my arm. "I don't know what I'm to do." "Don't be alarmed," said I. "There's nothing to be afraid of. Step into a shop and I'll soon get rid of this fellow." "No, no, child," she returned. "Don't speak to him for the world. I entreat, I order you." "Good heaven," answered I, "he's nothing but a sturdy beggar." "You don't know what he is," replied my aunt. "You don't know who he is. You don't know what you say." We'd stopped in an empty doorway while this was passing, and he had stopped too. "Don't look at him," said my aunt, as I turned my head indignantly. "But get me a coach, my dear, and wait for me in St. Paul's Churchyard." "Wait for you?" I repeated. "Yes," rejoined my aunt. "I must go alone. I must go with him." "With him, aunt? This man? I am in my senses," she replied, "and I tell you I must. Get me a coach." However much astonished I might be, I was sensible that I had no right to refuse compliance with such a peremptory command. I hurried away a few paces and called a hackney chariot which was passing empty. Almost before I could let down the steps, my aunt sprang in, I don't know how, and the man followed. She waved her hand to me to go away so earnestly that, all confounded as I was, I turned from them at once. In doing so, I heard her say to the coachman, "Drive anywhere! Drive straight on!" And presently the chariot passed me, going up the hill. What Mr. Dick had told me, and what I'd supposed to be a delusion of his, now came into my mind. I could not doubt that this person was the person of whom he had made such mysterious mention, though what the nature of his hold upon my aunt could possibly be, I was quite unable to imagine. After half an hour's cooling in the churchyard, I saw the chariot coming back. The driver stopped beside me, and my aunt was sitting in it alone. She had not yet sufficiently recovered from her agitation to be quite prepared for the visit we had to make. She desired me to get into the chariot and to tell the coachman to drive slowly up and down a little while. She said no more except, "My dear child, never ask me what it was, and don't refer to it," until she had perfectly regained her composure, when she told me she was quite herself now and we might get out. On her giving me her purse to pay the driver, I found that all the guineas were gone, and only the loose silver remained. Doctors' Commons was approached by a little low archway. Before we'd taken many paces down the street beyond it, the noise of the city seemed to melt, as if by magic, into a softened distance. A few dull courts and narrow ways brought us to the skylighted offices of Spenlow and Jorkins. In the vestibule of which temple, accessible to pilgrims without the ceremony of knocking, three or four clerks were at work as copyists. One of these, a little dry man sitting by himself who wore a stiff brown wig that looked as if it were made of gingerbread, rose to receive my aunt and show us into Mr. Spenlow's room.
"Mr. Spenlow's in court, ma'am," said the dry man. "It's an Archie's day. But it's close by, and I'll send for him directly."
As we were left to look about us while Mr. Spenlow was fetched, I availed myself of the opportunity. The furniture of the room was old-fashioned and dusty, and the green baize on the top of the writing-table had lost all its colour, and was as withered and pale as an old pauper. There were a great many bundles of papers on it, some endorsed as allegations, and some, to my surprise, as libels, and some as being in the Consistory Court, and some in the Arches Court, and some in the Prerogative Court, and some in the Admiralty Court, and some in the Delegates Court, giving me occasion to wonder much how many courts there might be in the gross and how long it would take to understand them all. Besides these, there were sundry immense manuscript books of evidence taken on affidavit, strongly bound and tied together in massive sets, a set to each cause, as if every cause were a history in 10 or 20 volumes. All this looked tolerably expensive, I thought, and gave me an agreeable notion of a proctor's business. I was casting my eyes with increasing complacency over these and many similar objects, when hasty footsteps were heard in the room outside, and Mr. Spenlow, in a black gown trimmed with white fur, came hurrying in, taking off his hat as he came. He was a little light-haired gentleman with undeniable boots and the stiffest of white cravats and shirt collars. He was buttoned up, mighty trim and tight, and must have taken a great deal of pains with his whiskers, which were accurately curled. His gold watch-chain was so massive that a fancy came across me that he ought to have a sinewy golden arm to draw it out with, like those which are put up over the gold-beaters' shops. He was got up with such care, and was so stiff, that he could hardly bend himself, being obliged, when he glanced at some papers on his desk after sitting down in his chair, to move his whole body from the bottom of his spine, like Punch. I had previously been presented by my aunt, and had been courteously received. He now said, "And so, Mr. Copperfield, you think of entering our profession? I casually mentioned to Miss Trotwood, when I had the pleasure of an interview with her the other day," with another inclination of his body, Punch again, "that there was a vacancy here. Miss Trotwood was good enough to mention that she had a nephew who was her peculiar care, and for whom she was seeking to provide genteelly in life. That nephew, I believe, I have now the pleasure of." Punch again. I bowed my acknowledgements and said my aunt had mentioned to me that there was that opening, and that I believed I should like it very much, that I was strongly inclined to like it, and had taken immediately to the proposal, that I couldn't absolutely pledge myself to like it until I knew something more about it, that although it was little else than a matter of form, I presumed I should have an opportunity of trying how I liked it before I bound myself to it irrevocably. "Oh, surely, surely," said Mr. Spenlow. "We always in this house propose a month, an initiatory month. I should be happy myself to propose 2 months, three, an indefinite period, in fact, but I have a partner, Mr. Jorkins." "And the premium, sir," I returned, "is £1,000. "And the premium, stamp included, is £1,000, said Mr. Spenlow. "As I have mentioned to Miss Trotwood, I am actuated by no mercenary considerations. Few men are less so, I believe. But Mr. Jorkins has his opinions on these subjects, and I am bound to respect Mr. Jorkins' opinions. Mr. Jorkins thinks £1,000 too little, in short." "I suppose, sir," said I, still desiring to spare my aunt, "that it is not the custom here, if an articled clerk were particularly useful and made himself a perfect master of his profession, I couldn't help blushing, this looked so like praising myself. I suppose it's not the custom in the later years of his time to allow him any... Mr. Spenlow, by a great effort, just lifted his head far enough out of his cravat to shake it, and answered, anticipating the word salary, "No. I will not say what consideration I might give to that point myself, Mr. Copperfield, if I were unfettered. Mr. Jawkins is immovable." I was quite dismayed by the idea of this terrible Jawkins. But I find out afterwards that he was a mild man of a heavy temperament whose place in the business was to keep himself in the background and be constantly exhibited by name as the most obdurate and ruthless of men. If a clerk wanted his salary raised, Mr. Jawkins wouldn't listen to such a proposition. If a client were slow to settle his bill of costs, Mr. Jawkins was resolved to have it paid. And however painful these things might be, and always were, to the feelings of Mr. Spenlow, Mr. Jawkins would have his bond. The heart and hand of the good angel Spenlow would have been always open but for the restraining demon Jawkins. As I've grown older, I think I've had experience of some other houses doing business on the principle of Spenlow and Jawkins. It was settled that I should begin my month's probation as soon as I pleased, and that my aunt need neither remain in town nor return at its expiration, as the articles of agreement of which I was to be the subject could easily be sent to her at home for her signature. When we got so far, Mr. Spenlow offered to take me into court then and there and show me what sort of place it was. As I was willing enough to know, we went out with this object, leaving my aunt behind. Who would trust herself, she said, in no such place, and who, I think, regarded all courts of law as a sort of powder mills that might blow up at any time. Mr. Spenlow conducted me through a paved courtyard formed of grave brick houses, which I inferred from the doctors' names upon the doors to be the official abiding places of the learned advocates of whom Steerforth had told me, and into a large, dull room, not unlike a chapel, to my thinking, on the left hand. The upper part of this room was fenced off from the rest, and there, on the two sides of a raised platform of the horseshoe form, sitting on easy, old-fashioned dining-room chairs, were sundry gentlemen in red gowns and grey wigs, whom I found to be the doctors aforesaid. Blinking over a little desk like a pulpit desk in the curve of the horseshoe was an old gentleman whom, if I'd seen him in an aviary, I should certainly have taken for an owl, but who I learned was the presiding judge. In the space within the horseshoe, lower than these, that's to say, on about the level of the floor, were sundry other gentlemen of Mr. Spenlow's rank, and dressed like him in black gowns with white fur upon them, sitting at a long green table. Their cravats were, in general, stiff, I thought, and their looks haughty. But in this last respect, I presently conceived I'd done them an injustice, for when two or three of them had to rise and answer a question of the presiding dignitary, I never saw anything more sheepish. The public, represented by a boy with a comforter, and a shabby, genteel man secretly eating crumbs out of his coat pockets, was warming itself at a stove in the centre of the court. The languid stillness of the place was only broken by the chirping of this fire, and by the voice of one of the doctors, who was wandering slowly through a perfect library of evidence, and stopping to put up from time to time in little roadside inns of argument on the journey. Altogether, I have never on any occasion made one at such a cosy, dozy, old-fashioned, time-forgotten, sleepy-headed little family party in all my life, and I felt it would be quite a soothing opiate to belong to it in any character, except perhaps as a suitor. Very well satisfied with the dreamy nature of this retreat, I informed Mr. Spenlow that I had seen enough for that time, and we rejoined my aunt, in company with whom I presently departed from the Commons, feeling very young when I went out of Spenlow and Jawkins's, on account of the clerks poking one another with their pens to point me out. We arrived at Lincoln's Inn Fields without any new adventures, except encountering an unlucky donkey in a costermonger's cart who suggested painful associations to my aunt. We had another long talk about my plans when we were safely housed, and as I knew she was anxious to get home, and between fire, food, and pickpockets could never be considered at her ease for half an hour in London, I urged her not to be uncomfortable on my account, but to leave me to take care of myself. "I've not been here a week tomorrow without considering that too, my dear," she returned. "There's a furnished little set of chambers to be let in the Adelphi, Trot, which ought to suit you to a marvel." With this brief introduction, she produced from her pocket an advertisement, carefully cut out of a newspaper, setting forth that in Buckingham Street in the Adelphi there was to be let, furnished with a view of the river, a singularly desirable and compact set of chambers, forming a genteel residence for a young gentleman, a member of one of the Inns of Court, or otherwise, with immediate possession. Terms moderate, and could be taken for a month only if required. "Why, this is the very thing, aunt," said I, flushed with the possible dignity of living in chambers. "Then come," replied my aunt, immediately resuming the bonnet she had a minute before laid aside. "We'll go and look at 'em." Away we went. The advertisement directed us to apply to Mrs. Crupp on the premises, and we rang the area bell, which we supposed to communicate with Mrs. Crupp. It was not until we'd rung three or four times that we could prevail on Mrs. Crupp to communicate with us. But at last she appeared, being a stout lady with a flounce of flannel petticoat below a nankeen gown. "Let us see these chambers of yours, if you please, ma'am," said my aunt. "For this gentleman?" said Mrs. Crupp, feeling in her pocket for her keys. "Yes, for my nephew," said my aunt. "And a sweet set of his visage," said Mrs. Crupp. So we went upstairs. They were on the top of the house, a great point with my aunt being near the fire escape, and consisted of a little half-blind entry where you could see hardly anything, a little stone-blind pantry where you could see nothing at all, a sitting-room and a bedroom. The furniture was rather faded, but quite good enough for me, and, sure enough, the river was outside the windows. As I was delighted with the place, my aunt and Mrs. Crupp withdrew into the pantry to discuss the terms, while I remained on the sitting-room sofa, hardly daring to think it possible that I could be destined to live in such a noble residence. After a single combat of some duration, they returned, and I saw to my joy, both in Mrs. Crupp's countenance and in my aunt's, that the deed was done. "Is it the last occupant's furniture?" inquired my aunt. "Yes, it is, ma'am," said Mrs. Crupp. "What's become of him?" asked my aunt. Mrs. Crupp was taken with a troublesome cough, in the midst of which she articulated with much difficulty, "He was took ill here, ma'am, and dear me, and he died." "What did he die of?" asked my aunt. Well, ma'am, he died of drink," said Mrs. Crupp in confidence, "and smoke." "Smoke? You don't mean chimneys?" said my aunt. "No, ma'am," returned Mrs. Crupp. "Cigars and pipes." "That's not catching, Trot, at any rate," remarked my aunt, turning to me. "No, indeed," said I. In short, my aunt, seeing how enraptured I was with the premises, took them for a month with leave to remain for 12 months when that time was out. Mrs. Crupp was to find linen and to cook. Every other necessary was already provided, and Mrs. Crupp expressly intimated that she should always yearn towards me as a son. I was to take possession the day after tomorrow, and Mrs. Crupp said thank heaven she had now found someone she could care for. On our way back, my aunt informed me how she confidently trusted that the life I was now to lead would make me firm and self-reliant, which was all I wanted. She repeated this several times next day in the intervals of our arranging for the transmission of my clothes and books from Mr. Wickfield's, relative to which, and to all my late holiday, I wrote a long letter to Agnes, of which my aunt took charge as she was to leave on the succeeding day. Not to lengthen these particulars, I need only add that she made a handsome provision for all my possible wants during my month of trial, that Steerforth, to my great disappointment and hers too, did not make his appearance before she went away, that I saw her safely seated in the Dover coach, exulting in the coming discomfiture of the vagrant donkeys with Janet at her side, and that when the coach was gone I turned my face to the Adelphi, pondering on the old days when I used to roam about its subterranean arches and on the happy changes which had brought me to the surface. Chapter 24. My First Dissipation. It was a wonderfully fine thing to have that lofty castle to myself, and to feel, when I shut my outer door, like Robinson Crusoe when he got into his fortification and pulled his ladder up after him. It was a wonderfully fine thing to walk about town with the key of my house in my pocket, and to know that I could ask any fellow to come home and make quite sure of its being inconvenient to nobody, if it were not so to me. It was a wonderfully fine thing to let myself in and out, and to come and go without a word to anyone, and to ring Mrs. Crupp up gasping from the depths of the earth when I wanted her, and when she was disposed to come. All this, I say, was wonderfully fine, but I must say, too, that there were times when it was very dreary. It was fine in the morning, particularly in the fine mornings. It looked a very fresh, free life by daylight, still fresher and more free by sunlight. But as the day declined, the life seemed to go down too. I don't know how it was, it seldom looked well by candlelight. I wanted somebody to talk to then. I missed Agnes. I found a tremendous blank in the place of that smiling repository of my confidence. Mrs. Crupp appeared to be a long way off. I thought about my predecessor who had died of drink and smoke, and I could have wished he'd been so good as to live and not bother me with his decease. After 2 days and nights, I felt as if I'd lived there for a year, and yet I wasn't an hour older, but was quite as much tormented by my own youthfulness as ever. Steerforth, not yet appearing, which induced me to apprehend that he must be ill, I left the Commons early on the third day and walked out to Highgate. Mrs. Steerforth was very glad to see me, and said that he had gone away with one of his Oxford friends to see another who lived near St. Albans, but that she expected him to return tomorrow. I was so fond of him that I felt quite jealous of his Oxford friends. As she pressed me to stay to dinner, I remained, and I believe we talked about nothing but him all day. I told her how much the people liked him at Yarmouth, and what a delightful companion he'd been. Miss Darkle was full of hints and mysterious questions, but took a great interest in all our proceedings there, and said, "Was it really, though?" and so forth so often that she got everything out of me she wanted to know. Her appearance was exactly what I've described it when I first saw her, but the society of the two ladies was so agreeable and came so natural to me that I felt myself falling a little in love with her. I couldn't help thinking several times in the course of the evening, and particularly when I walked home at night, what delightful company she would be in Buckingham Street. I was taking my coffee and roll in the morning before going to the Commons, and I may observe in this place that it's surprising how much coffee Mrs. Crupp used, and how weak it was, considering, when Steerforth himself walked into my unbounded joy. "My dear Steerforth," cried I began to think I should never see you again. "I was carried off by force of arms," said Steerforth, "the very next morning after I got home. Why, Daisy, what a rare old bachelor you are here!" I showed him over the establishment, not omitting the pantry, with no little pride, and he commended it highly. "I tell you what, old boy," he added, "I shall make quite a townhouse of this place unless you give me notice to quit." This was a delightful hearing. I told him if he waited for that, he would have to wait till doomsday. "But you shall have some breakfast," said I, with my hand on the bell rope, "and Mrs. Crupp shall make you some fresh coffee, and I'll toast you some bacon in a bachelor's Dutch oven that I've got here." "No, no," said Steerforth, "don't ring, I can't. I'm going to breakfast with one of these fellows who's at the Piazza Hotel in Covent Garden." "But you'll come back to dinner," said I. "I can't, upon my life. There's nothing I should like better, but I must remain with these two fellows. We're all three off together tomorrow morning." "Then bring them here to dinner," I returned. "Do you think they'd come?" "Oh, they'd come fast enough," said Steerforth, "but we should inconvenience you. You would better come and dine with us somewhere." I wouldn't by any means consent to this, for it occurred to me that I really ought to have a little housewarming, and that there never could be a better opportunity. I had a new pride in my rooms after his approval of them, and burned with a desire to develop their utmost resources. I therefore made him promise positively in the names of his two friends, and we appointed 6 o'clock as the dinner hour. When he was gone, I rang for Mrs. Crupp, and acquainted her with my desperate design. Mrs. Crupp said in the first place, of course it was well known she couldn't be expected to wait, but she knew a handy young man who she thought could be prevailed upon to do it, and whose terms would be 5 shillings and what I pleased. I said certainly we'd have him. Next, Mrs. Crupp said it was clear she couldn't be in 2 places at once, which I felt to be reasonable, and that a young gal stationed in the pantry with a bedroom candle there never to desist from washing plates would be indispensable. I said what would be the expense of this young female, and Mrs. Crupp said she supposed 18 pence would neither make me nor break me. I said I supposed not, and that was settled. Then Mrs. Crupp said, "Now, about the dinner." It was a remarkable instance of want of forethought on the part of the ironmonger who had made Mrs. Crupp's kitchen fireplace, that it was capable of cooking nothing but chops and mashed potatoes. "As to a fish kettle," Mrs. Crupp said, "well, would I only come and look at the range? She couldn't say fairer than that, would I come and look at it?" As I shouldn't have been much the wiser if I had looked at it, I declined, and said, "Never mind fish." But Mrs. Crupp said, "Don't say that. Oysters was in, and why not them?" So that was settled. Mrs. Crupp then said what she would recommend would be this: a pair of hot roast fowls from the pastry cooks, a dish of stewed beef with vegetables from the pastry cooks, 2 little corner things as a raised pie and a dish of kidneys from the pastry cooks, a tart, and if I liked, a shape of jelly from the pastry cooks. This, Mrs. Crupp said, would leave her at full liberty to concentrate her mind on the potatoes and to serve up the cheese and celery as she could wish to see it done.
This ends side 1 of cassette 12. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.
I acted on Mrs. Crupp's opinion, and gave the order at the pastry cook's myself. Walking along the Strand afterwards, and observing a hard, mottled substance in the window of a ham and beef shop, which resembled marble but was labelled mock turtle, I went in and bought a slab of it, which I have since seen reason to believe would have sufficed for 15 people. This preparation Mrs. Crupp, after some difficulty, consented to warm up. And it shrunk so much in a liquid state that we found it what Steerforth called rather a tight fit for 4. These preparations happily completed, I bought a little dessert in Covent Garden Market and gave a rather extensive order at a retail wine merchant's in that vicinity. When I came home in the afternoon and saw the bottles drawn up in a square on the pantry floor, they looked so numerous, though there were 2 missing, which made Mrs. Crupp very uncomfortable, that I was absolutely frightened at them. One of Steerforth's friends was named Granger, and the other Markham. They were both very gay and lively fellows. Granger, something older than Steerforth. Markham, youthful-looking, and I should say not more than 20. I observed that the latter always spoke of himself indefinitely as a man, and seldom or never in the first person singular. "A man might get on very well here, Mr. Copperfield," said Markham, meaning himself. "It's not a bad situation," said I, "and the rooms are really commodious." "I hope you've both brought appetites with you," said Steerforth. "Upon my honour," returned Markham, "towns seems to sharpen a man's appetite. A man's hungry all day long, a man is perpetually eating." Being a little embarrassed at first, and feeling much too young to preside, I made Steerforth take the head of the table when dinner was announced, and seated myself opposite to him. Everything was very good. We didn't spare the wine, and he exerted himself so brilliantly to make the thing pass off well that there was no pause in our festivity. I wasn't quite such good company during dinner as I could have wished to be, for my chair was opposite the door,
and my attention was distracted by observing that the handy young man went out of the room very often, and that his shadow always presented itself immediately afterwards on the wall of the entry with a bottle at its mouth. The young gal likewise occasioned me some uneasiness, not so much by neglecting to wash the plates as by breaking them. For being of an inquisitive disposition and unable to confine herself, as her positive instructions were, to the pantry, she was constantly peering in at us and constantly imagining herself detected, in which belief she several times retired upon the plates, with which she had carefully paved the floor, and did a great deal of destruction. These, however, were small drawbacks, and easily forgotten when the cloth was cleared and the dessert put on the table, at which period of the entertainment the handy young man was discovered to be speechless. Giving him private directions to seek the society of Mrs. Crupp and to remove the young gal to the basement also, I abandoned myself to enjoyment. I began by being singularly cheerful and light-hearted. All sorts of half-forgotten things to talk about came rushing into my mind and made me hold forth in a most unwonted manner. I laughed heartily at my own jokes and everybody else's, called Steerforth to order for not passing the wine, made several engagements to go to Oxford, announced that I meant to have a dinner party exactly like that once a week until further notice, and madly took so much snuff out of Granger's box that I was obliged to go into the pantry and have a private fit of sneezing 10 minutes long. I went on by passing the wine faster and faster yet, and continually starting up the corkscrew to open more wine, long before any was needed. I proposed Steerforth's health. I said he was my dearest friend, the protector of my boyhood, and the companion of my prime. I said I was delighted to propose his health. I said I owed him more obligations than I could ever repay, and held him in a higher admiration than I could ever express. I finished by saying, "I'll give you Steerforth. God bless him. Hurrah!" We gave him 3 times 3, and another, and a good one to finish with. I broke my glass in going round the table to shake hands with him, and I said in 2 words, "Steerforth, you're the guiding star of my existence." I went on by finding suddenly that somebody was in the middle of a song. Markham was the singer, and he sang "When the Heart of a Man is Depressed with Care." He said when he'd sung it he would give us "Woman." I took objection to that, and I couldn't allow it. I said it was not a respectful way of proposing the toast, and I would never permit that toast to be drunk in my house otherwise than as the ladies. I was very high with him, mainly, I think, because I saw Steerforth and Granger laughing at me, or at him, or at both of us. He said a man was not to be dictated to. I said a man was. He said a man was not to be insulted then. I said he was right there. Never under my roof, where the lares were sacred and the laws of hospitality paramount. He said it was no derogation from a man's dignity to confess that I was a devilish good fellow. I instantly proposed his health. Somebody was smoking. We were all smoking. I was smoking, and trying to suppress a rising tendency to shudder. Steerforth had made a speech about me, in the course of which I had been affected almost to tears. I returned thanks, and hoped the present company would dine with me tomorrow, and the day after, each day at 5 o'clock, that we might enjoy the pleasures of conversation and society through a long evening. I felt called upon to propose an individual. I would give them my aunt, Miss Betsy Trotwood, the best of her sex. Somebody was leaning out of my bedroom window, refreshing his forehead against the cool stone of the parapet, and feeling the air upon his face. It was myself. I was addressing myself as Copperfield, and saying, "Why did you try to smoke? You might have known you couldn't do it." Now somebody was unsteadily contemplating his features in the looking-glass. That was I, too. I was very pale in the looking-glass. My eyes had a vacant appearance, and my hair, only my hair, nothing else, looked drunk.
somebody said to me, "Let's go to the theatre, Copperfield." There was no bedroom before me, but again the jingling table covered with glasses, the lamp, Granger on my right hand, Markham on my left, and Steerforth opposite, all sitting in a mist and a long way off. The theatre? To be sure, the very thing. Come along! But they must excuse me if I saw everybody out first and turned the lamp off, in case of fire. Owing to some confusion in the dark, the door was gone. I was feeling for it in the window curtains when Steerforth, laughing, took me by the arm and led me out. We went downstairs, one behind another. Near the bottom, somebody fell and rolled down. Somebody else said it was Copperfield. I was angry at that false report, until, finding myself on my back in the passage, I began to think there might be some foundation for it. A very foggy night, with great rings round the lamps in the streets. There was an indistinct talk of its being wet. I considered it frosty. Steerforth dusted me under a lamp post and put my hat into shape, which somebody produced from somewhere in a most extraordinary manner, for I hadn't had it on before. Steerforth then said, "You're all right, Copperfield, are you not?" And I told him, "There, there!" A man, sitting in a pigeonhole place, looked out of the fog and took money from somebody, inquiring if I was one of the gentlemen paid for, and appearing rather doubtful, as I remember in the glimpse I had of him, whether to take the money for me or not. Shortly afterwards, we were very high up in a very hot theatre, looking down into a large pit that seemed to me to smoke. The people with whom it was crammed were so indistinct. There was a great stage, too, looking very clean and smooth after the streets, and there were people upon it, talking about something or other, but not at all intelligibly. There was an abundance of bright lights, and there was music, and there were ladies down in the boxes, and I don't know what more. The whole building looked to me as if it were learning to swim. It conducted itself in such an unaccountable manner when I tried to steady it. On somebody's motion, we resolved to go downstairs to the dress boxes where the ladies were. A gentleman lounging, full-dressed on a sofa with an opera glass in his hand, passed before my view, and also my own figure at full length in a glass. Then I was being ushered into one of these boxes, and found myself saying something as I sat down, and people about me crying silence to somebody, and ladies casting indignant glances at me, and what? Yes, Agnes, sitting on the seat before me in the same box, with a lady and gentleman beside her whom I didn't know. I see her face now, better than I did then, I dare say, with its indelible look of regret and wonder turned upon me. "Agnes!" I said thickly. "Lord bless her, Agnes!" "Hush, pray!" she answered. I couldn't conceive why. "You disturb the company. Look at the stage." I tried, on her injunction, to fix it, and to hear something of what was going on there, but quite in vain. I looked at her again by and by, and saw her shrink into her corner, and put her gloved hand to her forehead. "Agnes," I said, "I'm afraid you're not well." "Yes, yes, don't mind me, Trotwood," she returned. "Listen, are you going away soon?"
"Did I go away, sir?" I repeated.
"Yes." I had a stupid intention of replying that I was going to wait to hand her downstairs. I suppose I expressed it somehow, for after she'd looked at me attentively for a little while, she appeared to understand, and replied in a low tone, "I know you will do as I ask you if I tell you I am very earnest in it. Go away now, Trotwood, for my sake, and ask your friends to take you home." She had so far improved me for a short time that though I was angry with her, I felt ashamed, and with a short "Grr!" which I intended for good night, got up and went away. They followed, and I stepped at once out of the box door into my bedroom.
where only Steerforth was with me, helping me to undress, and where I was by turns telling him that Agnes was my sister, and adjuring him to bring the corkscrew that I might open another bottle of wine. How somebody, lying in my bed, lay saying and doing all this over and over again, at cross purposes in a feverish dream all night, the bed a rocking sea that was never still, how, as that somebody slowly settled down into myself, did I begin to parch and feel as if my outer covering of skin were a hard board, my tongue the bottom of an empty kettle furred with long service and burning up over a slow fire, the palms of my hands hot plates of metal which no ice could cool. But the agony of mind, the remorse and shame I felt when I became conscious next day, my horror of having committed 1,000 offences I'd forgotten and which nothing could expiate, my recollection of that indelible look which Agnes had given me, the torturing impossibility of communicating with her, not knowing, beast that I was, how she came to be in London or where she stayed, my disgust of the very sight of the room where the revel had been held, my racking head, the smell of smoke, the sight of glasses, the impossibility of going out or even getting up. Oh, what a day it was! Oh, what an evening when I sat down by my fire to a basin of mutton broth dimpled all over with fat, and thought I was going the way of my predecessor and should succeed to his dismal story as well as to his chambers, and had half a mind to rush express to Dover and reveal all. What an evening! When Mrs. Crupp, coming in to take away the broth basin, produced one kidney on a cheese plate as the entire remains of yesterday's feast, and I was really inclined to fall upon her nankeen breast and say in heartfelt penitence, "Oh, Mrs. Crupp, Mrs. Crupp, never mind the broken meats. I am very miserable." Only that I doubted even at that pass if Mrs. Crupp were quite the sort of woman to confide in. Chapter 25. Good and Bad Angels. I was going out at my door on the morning after that deplorable day of headache, sickness, and repentance, with an odd confusion in mind relative to the date of my dinner party, as if a body of Titans had taken an enormous lever and pushed the day before yesterday some months back, when I saw a ticket porter coming upstairs with a letter in his hand. He was taking his time about his errand then, but when he saw me on the top of the staircase, looking at him over the banisters, he swung into a trot and came up panting as if he'd run himself into a state of exhaustion. "T. Copperfield, Esquire," said the ticket porter, touching his hat with his little cane. I could scarcely lay claim to the name, I was so disturbed by the conviction that the letter came from Agnes. However, I told him I was T. Copperfield, Esquire, and he believed it, and gave me the letter, which he said required an answer. I shut him out on the landing to wait for the answer, and went into my chambers again in such a nervous state that I was fain to lay the letter down on my breakfast table and familiarise myself with the outside of it a little before I could resolve to break the seal. I found, when I did open it, that it was a very kind note containing no reference to my condition at the theatre. All it said was, "My dear Trotwood, I am staying at the house of Papa's agent, Mr. Waterbrook, in Ely Place, Holborn. Will you come and see me today at any time you like to appoint? Ever yours affectionately, Agnes." It took me such a long time to write an answer at all to my satisfaction that I don't know what the ticket porter could have thought unless he thought I was learning to write. I must have written half a dozen answers, at least. I began one, "How can I ever hope, my dear Agnes, to efface from your remembrance the disgusting impression?" There, I didn't like it, and then I tore it up. I began another, "Shakespeare has observed, my dear Agnes, how strange it is that a man should put an enemy into his mouth." That reminded me of Markham, and it got no farther. I even tried poetry. I began one note in a 6-syllable line, "Oh, do not remember," but that associated itself with the 5th of November and became an absurdity. After many attempts, I wrote, "My dear Agnes, your letter is like you, and what could I say of it that would be higher praise than that? I will come at 4 o'clock, affectionately and sorrowfully, T.C. With this missive, which I was in 20 minds at once about recalling, as soon as it was out of my hands, the ticket-porter at last departed. If the day were half as tremendous to any other professional gentleman in Doctors' Commons as it was to me, I sincerely believe he made some expiation for his share in that rotten old ecclesiastical cheese. Although I left the office at 3:30, and was prowling about the place of appointment within a few minutes afterwards, the appointed time was exceeded by a full 1/4 hour, according to the clock of St. Andrew's, Holborn, before I could muster up sufficient desperation to pull the private bell-handle let into the left-hand doorpost of Mr. Waterbrook's house. The professional business of Mr. Waterbrook's establishment was done on the ground floor, and the genteel business, of which there was a good deal, in the upper part of the building. I was shown into a pretty but rather close drawing-room, and there sat Agnes, netting a purse. She looked so quiet and good, and reminded me so strongly of my airy, fresh school days at Canterbury, and the sodden, smoky, stupid wretch I'd been the other night, that nobody being by, I yielded to my self-reproach and shame, and, in short, made a fool of myself. I cannot deny that I shed tears. To this hour I'm undecided whether it was upon the whole the wisest thing I could have done, or the most ridiculous. "If it had been anyone but you, Agnes," said I, turning away my head, "I shouldn't have minded it half so much, but that it should have been you who saw me. I almost wish I'd been dead first." She put her hand, its touch was like no other hand, upon my arm for a moment, and I felt so befriended and comforted that I couldn't help moving it to my lips and gratefully kissing it. "Sit down," said Agnes cheerfully. "Don't be unhappy, Trotwood. If you cannot confidently trust me, whom will you trust?" "Oh, Agnes," I returned, "you are my good angel." She smiled, rather sadly, I thought, and shook her head. "Yes, Agnes, my good angel, always my good angel." "If I were indeed, Trotwood," she returned, "there is one thing that I should set my heart on very much." I looked at her inquiringly, but already with a foreknowledge of her meaning. "On warning you," said Agnes, with a steady glance, "against your bad angel." "My dear Agnes," I began, "if you mean Steerforth, I do, Trotwood," she returned. "Then, Agnes, you wrong him very much." "He, my bad angel, or anyone's? He, anything but a guide, a support, and a friend to me? My dear Agnes, now is it not unjust and unlike you to judge him from what you saw of me the other night?" "I do not judge him from what I saw of you the other night," she quietly replied. "From what, then?" "From many things. Trifles in themselves, but they do not seem to me to be so when they're put together. I judge him partly from your account of him, Trotwood, and your character, and the influence he has over you." There was always something in her modest voice that seemed to touch a chord within me, answering to that sound alone. It was always earnest. But when it was very earnest, as it was now, there was a thrill in it that quite subdued me. I sat looking at her as she cast her eyes down on her work. I sat, seeming still, to listen to her, and Steerforth, in spite of all my attachment to him, darkened in that tone. "It is very bold in me," said Agnes, looking up again, "who have lived in such seclusion and can know so little of the world, to give you my advice so confidently, or even to have this strong opinion. But I know in what it is engendered, Trotwood, in how true a remembrance of our having grown up together, and in how true an interest in all relating to you. It is that which makes me bold. I'm certain that what I say is right. I'm quite sure it is. I feel as if it was someone else speaking to you, and not I, when I caution you that you have made a dangerous friend." Again I looked at her. Again I listened to her after she was silent, and again his image, though it was still fixed in my heart, darkened. I'm not so unreasonable as to expect, said Agnes, resuming her usual tone after a little while, that you will or that you can at once change any sentiment that has become a conviction with you, least of all a sentiment that is rooted in your trusting disposition. You ought not hastily to do that. I only ask you, Trotwood, if you ever think of me, I mean, with a quiet smile, for I was going to interrupt her, and she knew why, as often as you think of